There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.
Hello and welcome to the Bite Size Business Breakfast, our daily podcast that brings together the very best bits from today's show on Monday, the 21st of October. Why should I pay? That is what employers are saying. What skills will employers really pay the big bucks for? That's the subject of a new report from the recruitment firm Robert Half. And what employers will pay for is tech skills. They want tech-savvy executives who can drive digital transformation within their organisations. And if you can do that, then you're in with a good shout. There is a war for talent. Gareth El-Maturi is the Associate Director at Robert Half. We asked him, what should people be studying? What skills should they be polishing to land those top jobs in 2020? And this is what he told us.
It's all about digital at the moment. That's the key word that we're seeing across the region. With the increase in fintech and e-commerce companies, which is the hot area at the moment, any candidates with digital experience who can bring a digital mindset, artificial intelligence, machine learning, cybersecurity, these are the skills which are in demand across the region.
Reminded you, Malcolm, of about 20 years ago when you paid to send yourself on a tech course.
Yeah, it was about the time I first got a laptop. The company gave me a laptop and said, here you are, we're going modern and we're taking away a secretary. I said, well, you there you are, you can do everything yourself on your laptop. I said, and you don't want to say, well, I don't know how to switch it on. So I was going on a holiday and I put myself on a two-day course at a small training company that was doing a Windows course. And I thought, this is the best way. So I paid £200 to go on this course for 2 days, who not only taught me how to turn the machine on, but they also taught me how to use it and how to taught me about the operating system and, of course, Word, which was sort of key business tool there for writing letters and sending things. And it was in the days before the internet, really, so it was all sort of print and sign and lick the envelope and put it in there in those days. But I had to do it myself because the company wasn't going to do it for me. And it was a skill that I had to have. I know it's very basic when you look at the sort of skills they're asking for today. It may not sound very impressive, but for me, never having turned a machine on before, it was pretty good.
What have you paid for in terms
you were
of skills?
Just booting it up all over the place. We boot this baby up? We've got it.
I know exactly. Once you learn the lingo, oh, yeah.
You could hear the little Microsoft chime out of Malcolm's office every 4.5 minutes. I've taken myself off before on voice training skills.
Good.
For radio. I went and saw someone in London while I was on holiday, similar to Malk's. And did a couple of days of learning how to do news reading without sounding like a Sky presenter.
or a Kiwi. Did they try to knock the accent out of you or not?
Do you know what? I have had that. I didn't pay for that. I was on a training program when I was about 18 or 19 in the UK with a well-known broadcaster who did sort of say, and I quote, you sound like a refugee from Neighbours, unquote. But
couldn't get away with that today, could you?
The one I did in London, when I say about the Sky News presenters, I'm not throwing shade there. They were basically saying not to fall into the sing-songy pattern that you automatically fall into when you're reading news. So they were trying to teach me not to do that. Regardless, yes, I have gone off and paid for more skills before because I thought it would help my career.
Rich?
Yeah, loads of things. I've done
football training.
Clearly. Voice coaching, again, when I was in London, but working at Bloomberg. I did have some training with them, but I paid to do more. I've done lots of public speaking courses that I've paid for. My first job in journalism was with the Sunday Sport newspaper. Let's call it journalism. That's a bit of poetic license. But I paid to go on a typing course for a week, touch typing course with old-fashioned typewriters that had no letters written on the keys, and you have to type them. And you know, it cost me £50 or something like that. It wasn't expensive at the time, but I took a week off work to do it. So yeah. So and the point we're making, and the point that Gareth was making, is that often these skills, which are in demand according to the survey, no one's going to pay for you to do them. If you want to acquire these skills, the ones he mentioned, a lot of them tech related, really the onus is on you. If you're lucky, you'll work for an employer who will give you those skills. I mean, we've had, for example, social media courses here, haven't we? It's very important to what we do. And from time to time, we get sent on social media courses. That's great, and I value them. But a lot of the time, really, it's kind of up to us, isn't it? Now, the other thing that people want from the survey, that's what employers want. They want those tech skills. What employees want, as well as salary increases and profit share, is they want flexibility, as Gareth explains.
So flexible working can mean different things to different people, whether it be starting early and finishing early, whether it be kind of taking a longer lunch. We are seeing a number of companies at the moment doing a kind of work 4.5 days and 5 or 9 and 10. So if every 2 weeks you get one day off, these benefits are kind of the hot area at the moment for employers.
And you were saying you're getting it at two opposite ends of the job market. One is the massive multinationals with 200,000 people and progressive HR policies. And at the other end of the scale, it's the young tech startups in the various incubators that are really struggling to attract talent. And they're the ones offering these perks, but in the middle, not so much.
Yeah, and what was really interesting was his survey found that 20% of employers know they're not offering enough sort of flexibility and other non-monetary perks and know that they're losing out on talent by not doing so. But they can't do it. And we said to him, well, if you know you're not getting the people you want because you can't offer them the stuff they want, change. And he said, why don't you change? And he said two initials, didn't he? They were H and they were R.
And the policies say no. Finally, we asked him, how's the job market shaping up for 2020? Look, we know anecdotally it's been tough for many people over the past couple of years. There have been, in many industries, job losses rather than recruitment drives. But he's pretty upbeat.
Positive. I've been in the region now 11 years and we're very optimistic about 2020. But for candidates who are going to be active in the market, I would say the key word is digital. If you can get those kind of key skills which are in demand, you're in a good set for next year.
That is the voice of Gareth El-Mahtouri. He's the Associate Director for Robert Half here.
This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast, exclusively on DubaiEye1038.com.
We're talking green energy because the World Green Energy Summit kicks off in Dubai today. And it's a real pleasure to welcome to the studio one of the pioneers of green energy in this region, the Chief Executive of Saudi Arabia's Aqua Power, Paddy Padmanabhan. Paddy, good to see you.
Delighted to be back here again. Thank you.
It's been a busy week for you already. It's only Monday, but reading that your organisation and the Emirates Water and Electricity Company yesterday closing a near $1 billion deal for a reverse osmosis desalination plant in Taweelah in the Emirate of Abu Dhabi. Tell us about that.
We're pretty delighted to have closed Taweelah. It's a 900,000 cubic metre a day desalinated water production plant using reverse osmosis technology. So it's the largest RO plant in the world. But what's more exciting for us and what we're really delighted about is the fact that we've been able to bring the cost of desalinated water down to below 50 cents per cubic meter, US cents that is, for the first time ever. Just to give you a kind of point of reference, just maybe within the last 5 years, that number would have been well above a dollar per cubic meter, valuing energy at a real price. So it's a spectacular sort of reduction, largely led by technology, innovation in technology, rapid improvements that is allowing us to deliver such value.
And so it would have been a dollar about 5 years ago.
Over a dollar. Well, $1.30, to be honest.
And say 20 years ago when Malcolm and I arrived in this region, and you've been here a long time as well, what were we paying then?
That would have been more like $3.30. So it's a phenomenal reduction.
And how have you done that in simple terms?
In very simple terms, you know, so very simple terms, reverse osmosis technology works by taking seawater and pressurizing it, putting it through a kind of a membrane, a filter, which creates osmotic pressure to liberate the salt ions. And then we take out then clean water. Now, so there are two things. The big thing that we use there is a lot of energy. It's a very energy intensive process. And we use technology. That membrane that we use that creates the osmotic pressure is very sophisticated. So the technology innovations have happened in many different. So first of all, the membranes have improved phenomenally. Membrane science has improved, so we are able to reduce the cost of membranes. They kind of coagulate, the flux less. It's much better. Then the energy itself, we are able to now recover energy. The energy recovery devices have become much, much more efficient. So we're able to not waste so much of energy. Then the cost of energy itself has come down. And the other little innovation in innovation in Taweelah is that we have been able to also harness the power of the sun. So when the sun is shining, we are going to use solar energy to supplement a more expensive fossil fuel-based energy that is supplied here in the Emirate. So all of that coming together. Also, to be fair, this is a very capital intensive process. So the low interest rate environment also helps us, to be fair. So it's a combination of many factors that have come together.
Green, good, lower electricity charges for people, excellent. How much is this going to bring my electricity bills down?
Look, everybody asks me the question. I think it's not going to happen overnight, but I have zero doubt that over a period of time, so over the next, I'd like to say next 5 years, but in reality, probably over the next decade, I am very convinced electricity prices at a retail level, at a consumer level, will probably come down by half.
Why would it not come down immediately?
Because only a small amount is getting added. Let's not sort of fool ourselves. We're adding all the new capacity that's coming in is coming in at a cheaper price. But we've got a huge amount of legacy capacity that is still there that needs to work to reliably give you electricity when you switch the light on, to be fair. So as we keep injecting new capacity coming in, 5%, 10%, 15%, 20%, so over a time, then the total cost will start coming down. Also, to be fair, in order to take in this new capacity, which is renewable energy, which is intermittent energy, which is fluctuating energy, we've got to put more expensive storage in. The grid also needs, the distribution system needs to be also adapted and modified to cope. So there is a lot more investment that needs to go in. So it's CapEx heavy, so there's a lot of upfront investments that needs to go in. So it'll take a decade, you know. Well, when I say a decade, I've always been proven wrong in the right way, in that it's happening much faster than people think. So I would like to think that within the next 5 to 7 years, we will really start seeing energy prices coming down.
So this is the biggest reverse osmosis plant in the world. It's almost 50% bigger than the next largest one.
Correct.
Is it the cheapest desalinated water in the world?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. That's what I said to you. I mean, you know, for the first time. So on a like-for-like basis, in comparing prices, one needs to be very careful because there's so many inputs that go into it, right? But one of the biggest inputs that go into desalination is the energy cost, and energy costs vary across the world. Subsidized, unsubsidized, it's very confusing. But if you equate everything, this particular tariff of below 50 cents is at real energy price, electricity at 8 cents per kilowatt hour, which is real price. So on a real price basis, below 50 cents, it's shockingly low. It's one of the lowest in the world.
We got questions coming in. Someone calling themselves Green in Dubai says, very simply, Paddy, when will we stop burning fossil fuels for power and desalination? Petroleum should only be used for producing plastics and medicines, not burned.
Look, Dubai already has a very aggressive strategy. DEWA has published a very aggressive strategy of rapidly introducing renewable energy at increasing pace. My personal prediction, the safe bet by 2050, I do not expect to see any fossil fuel being burnt for electricity. That's an easy one to predict. I would like to think it's probably faster than 2050. That's kind of the numbers that I'm convinced that many countries across the world are working to, because that will not only be the right thing to do from a carbon perspective, but it will also be the most cost competitive thing.
What is going to be the power source that replaces hydrocarbon? Because obviously desalination plants are pretty energy heavy.
Well, the source that, look, sun is going to play a significant feature, but sun, it's a combination of, it's not going to be one thing. So it's going to be sun, wind. I am also very convinced that using the sun and the wind sort of naturally delivered energy, we would be able to then produce hydrogen, green hydrogen. So taking electrolysis, fractioning the water, producing hydrogen. A combination of several different technologies will come in, and battery technology will improve for storage. So an integration of in this part of the world. Now, across the rest of the world, there is hydropower, there is geothermal power.
Waves.
Every
tides.
Well, tidal waves, why not? But we're not quite there yet. But I don't want to rule out any technology, but definitely, there are lots more technology that is available using natural energy sources.
Paddy, 30 seconds. One of our other stories today is about the war for talent and salaries here in the UAE. You're at the cutting edge of green energy, whether it comes to some of the solar you're doing or the reverse osmosis in producing desalinated water. What challenges are you finding or facing to find top talent who can do this stuff?
No, talent, that is the huge issue. For us, the constraint is not opportunities, is not capital. It is very much about talent. It's about, look, there are a lot of young people are coming into the sector. That's good news. But what we are looking for are passionate people who are committed, who want to make a difference, who are not only just technically qualified, but who want to fight to reduce the cost and make a difference. It's challenging. The biggest area that we are trying to focus on is women. Not enough girls are coming into technology. I'm starting to see more rushing into things like legal profession and finance, which is good. Not going to stop that. But definitely we need more technologists, engineers coming in. And there is 50% of society out there that's not coming in into the sector. So that is the area that I think we can make a big difference on if we focus.
Paddy Padmanabhan is the chief executive of Aquapower from Saudi Arabia. Really appreciate your time. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Delighted to be here.
Catch up on the business headlines with the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast.
There is a federal election in Canada today, and we've been looking at what that means for the UAE's business relationships with the country, whether they're going to change depending on who gets elected. Our producer, Mohammed Suleiman, has this special report.
Oh, Canada, our home and native land.
Canadians go to the polls today to choose their next prime minister. Although half a dozen main political parties are vying for power, the election has come down to a two-horse race between the Liberals, led by incumbent leader Justin Trudeau, and the Conservatives, who are led by Andrew Scheer. It's been a campaign trail that's been marred by controversies, none larger than Trudeau's blackface scandal. Although many Canadians are prepared to look beyond the prime minister's past mistakes, the country's opposition leader clearly isn't.
Justin Trudeau only pretends to stand up for Canada. He's very good at pretending things. He can't even remember how many times he put blackface on, because the fact of the matter is he's always wearing a mask. Mr. Trudeau, you are a phony and you are a fraud and you do not deserve to govern this country.
But Andrew Scheer hasn't been short of controversy himself. Earlier this month, it was revealed that the Conservative leader was a dual citizen, holding a second passport belonging to, of all countries, the USA. Scandals aside, relations between the UAE and Canada could also be affected by what happens in Ottawa today. Experts say a minority Liberal government under Trudeau could be good news for relations between the two countries. According to figures from the UAE's Ministry of Economy, commercial trade between Canada and the UAE reached close to 7.8 billion dirhams last year. There's every chance that those numbers could continue to grow if Canadians decide to give Justin Trudeau 4 more years in Parliament. This is Mohammed Suleiman reporting for the Business Breakfast.
We've also been speaking to Greg Zogby, who is the chairperson of the Canadian Business Council in Abu Dhabi. One thing that's really interesting about the election in Canada this year is that expats who've been out of the country for more than 5 years can vote for the first time. Previously, you had to have only been away for less than 5 years. So we've been asking him about the response to that amongst the expat community here.
To be honest, it's been really exciting just talking, with members of the councils and friends and family relatives, and many of them have rushed to get the polls, get registered. So I think you'll see a lot of Canadians in the UAE voting for sure, and it's very exciting.
We also asked Greg how the election results will impact UAE-Canada relations.
I think we've seen a lot of progress over the past couple of years, whether it's regarding to the flight or the commitment to Expo 2020. We've seen a lot of, we've seen the waiver for the Emiratis to visit Canada. And so as far as the elections, we don't see any impact on the Canada-UAE relations. As a matter of fact, I think the relations are on a positive path forward, and this will continue.
That's Greg Zogby. I would have thought Canada and the amount of the diaspora around the world that have been overseas for more than 5 years, it might be a game-changing number.
Well,
no idea of the numbers, but I'm sure it's big.
It's the sort of thing that a lot of people think that overseas votes and special votes don't count. But I know for my own country that special votes, which includes overseas votes, were actually, by a lot of people, credited at swinging the last election.
So you've got, 4 million people in New Zealand, is it? 3 million to 4 million, something like that? And then about the same overseas. So you can see why.
Yes,
exactly. The same with Ireland. They've got the same issue, haven't they?
We've also been asking about what the election will be fought on.
Yeah, some of the big issues that are on the agenda, and these are they.
So far, the issues have been primarily domestic, whether related to the carbon tax, for example, manufacturing, healthcare, jobs, minimum wages. So this so far has been the focus of the elections, and I think that's what Canadians are going to vote on.
Just the highlights. This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast. Newsmakers.
The movers and shakers shaping your world.
My newsmaker is the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, His Highness Mohammed bin Salman, but it's got nothing to do with Saudi Arabia and everything to do with my hometown.
Well, a valiant performance from Manchester United. They've ended Liverpool's perfect start to the season. A 1-1 draw. Spanish United 1, Liverpool 1.
That was commentary from last night's game between Manchester United, my home team, and Liverpool. It ended, as the man said, with a 1-1 draw. But there could be changes at the top at Manchester United. Lots of media reports in the UK suggesting that Mohammed bin Salman has made a second bid to buy Manchester United of about $4 billion. It's been rejected. But the Mirror and the Sun newspapers, probably the two most authoritative sources on the football industry in the United Kingdom, say that a third bid of even more is being prepared.
It's owned by the Glazer family at the moment. How much did they pay for it?
They paid, as you'll hear from Chris McCarty, who I spoke to yesterday about this, about $1 billion,
right,
14 years ago. It's now listed on the stock exchange in the United States, where it has a value of about $2.6 billion. So he's prepared to offer a healthy premium, again, according to unconfirmed reports. But let Chris tell you what's going on. Chris McCarty, he's, of course, the presenter of Off Script. He's the head of sport here at the Arabian Radio Network and a diehard Manchester United supporter. So the first thing I asked him about was these rumours circulating, once again, not for the first time, that Saudi Arabia looking to buy the football club.
Yes, the Saudi Royals' interest, it's been murmured, it's been rumoured for a long time now. I don't think the Glazers sell up for anything under $3.5 billion. Is that the type of money that the Saudis will be willing to part with? As I say, I've got my doubts.
But he mentioned the Glazers there, and you mentioned them, Malcolm. It's an American family that currently effectively own Manchester United. It is listed on the New York Stock Exchange, has been for 5 years now, but only about 15% of it is listed. They own about 85% of it. Malcolm Taylor, Malcolm Taylor, the patriarch.
I'm happy to accept $3.5 billion, I'm telling you.
Malcolm Glazer was the patriarch of the family. He did the deal. He's a rags to riches story in the United States, owned the Tampa Bay football team as well. And he bought Man United about 5 years ago. Now his six kids own about 13% each, and they're not very popular in Manchester. And Chris McCarty explains why.
It's been 14 years since the Glazers took over at Manchester United, that controversial leveraged buyout, £790 million. Sir Alex Ferguson did a wonderful job papering over the cracks. Since his departure, it has been one disaster to the next. And the Glazers, they don't really care. You know, as long as they make a profit every fiscal year, they are happy to bleed that football club dry.
Bleed the club dry, yeah, yeah, is how Chris.
And he's a fan, isn't he?
He's a Manchester United fan. They do take dividends out of the club. And the comparison is the Glazer family bought Manchester United just before Sheikh Mansour bought Manchester City. Since the Glazers bought Manchester United, they've gone from strength to weakness, and Manchester City have gone from also-rans to being arguably the best club and the best team in the entire world. And therefore, they're not particularly popular among Chris McCarty and other supporters as well. I think they're going to sell. And I'll tell you why I think they're going to sell. Partly for, mainly for financial reasons. The Glazer kids, and the six of them, own about 13% each. And they get, the dividends paid out last year were about $30 million. And after shareholders listed on the stock market, they got about $4 million each in dividends from this football club. Okay, which is nice. I would take it. But from an asset that's worth, what, $4 billion, I did the numbers. And Kevin Glazer, one of the kids, has actually put his shares up for sale. So he got about $4 million in dividends last year. At the prices being talked about, he'd walk away with $500 million. 13%, $4 billion, do the maths, about $500 million. If he invested that in a kind of Vanguard tracker fund or an iShares tracker fund, dividend-paying tracker fund.
3% a year, something like that?
They're paying 5% a year. The high dividend tracker funds in the UK, where Man United's based, or the US, where he's based, they're paying about 5%. He'd get $25 million a year on $500 million. Simple maths. Mm. So at the moment he's getting 4, he could get 25 in a low-cost ETF tracker fund that you and I could buy today. And he's got access, obviously, to far smarter minds than that. So I think he might. He's put his shares up for sale last week. That's only one out of the six, but I think they might do it.
I wonder what that means for Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, who probably rescued his job with a 1-1 draw last night. What do you think?
Well, Chris's final thoughts were on not just the ownership, but also the management of Manchester United on and off the pitch. Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, as you say, is the football manager. He's the coach. But there's another guy called Ed Woodward, who's the CEO, the business manager. And Chris McCarthy thinks they both need to go.
Ed Woodward, the CEO, I've got no doubt he can get the deals done. He can entice your tyre manufacturers, your paint manufacturers, your airlines. He's not a football man, though. He is out of his depth. Ole Gunnar Solskjaer is out of his depth. And it's going to be a long road back for Manchester United, certainly with the Glazers at the helm.
You can tell he's been celebrating. His voice is kind of rough. He just had a baby girl.
He did, didn't he? Just a few days ago he had a baby. And Chris recorded that and sent that to me at midnight last night. I remember those days of being awake at midnight changing nappies.
One question I have for you. You introduced that and said and referred to it as the Saudi bid. Is this Mohammed bin Salman's personal money? Is his own? Or is he making a bid on behalf of Saudi Arabia?
Well, it's an interesting point you make. And the British media, certainly, are variously describing it as a Saudi bid, a bid by the Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, or a bid by the Saudi ruling family. And we know in every country the lines are blurred between whether the fortunes of the ruling family are personal or part of the state. I mean, we've had that in the UK for 500 years now or longer. But that's Saudi Arabia. Let's leave it at that. Thanks very much indeed for listening. We're back tomorrow morning from 6 a.m.
There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.